Danse, Anin, Boujou, hello, and welcome. This is Unreserved. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. An intersection is a point where two things converge or cross. While usually associated with a place, it can also be an action. Michaela Thompson uses beads to express her biracial identity. And as she explores her Namipu and Nigerian roots, she invites others to find their own connections to the work.
So I think it's very beautiful in that way to be able to not only share who I am, but also connect with others in their own way through this perform.
Hip-hop pulled Cree music maker Dakota Bear off a path towards gangs and violence. Now he's building a creative space that elevates Indigenous talent and offers opportunities to youth.
And that's what we're really doing is, you know, building these platforms ourselves, building out distribution ourselves, building out booking systems ourselves, stay Indigenous focused, Indigenous led, Indigenous owned.
And believed to be the first Inuk teacher in Canada, Evelyn Campbell found ways of incorporating Inuit culture into a Western education system that too often left us out.
Being able to highlight Inuit and Labrador culture within the school made it something that you're proud of.
Today, whether it's beads, beats, or breaking trails in education, these Indigenous people found themselves at a crossroads and chose change. Welcome to Land Back Labs, a space filled with artists of all ages, including little Nico.
My name is Nico.
And you like making music?
And I like making music with my dad.
His dad, Dakota Bear, is behind this music space in Vancouver's downtown east side. We'll hear from him a little later. But right now, let's head into the lab. The walls are lined with computers, microphones, and various instruments. Around the room, students are learning how to sing, rap, and make beats. There's a stack of pizza box over at the door. It's all part of a pilot program at the studio, giving kids the space and support they need to express themselves.
Yeah, my name is Jeremy Parkin. I'm from Whitehorse in the Yukon Territory. My family is from the Kwalandun First Nation, and I'm a music producer, instrumentalist from up north, yeah. We are at the Landback Labs space on East Georgia in Vancouver, British Columbia, hosting a little pilot workshop. The workshop is about kind of just like an introduction to music production and recording for Indigenous youth.
My name is Mizzy Mejia. I am of Kampampangan and Ilocano blood from the Philippines.
What we've done is these two amazing students, Lana and Mirna, have crafted their own beat. They produced it themselves. So we've taught them about, you know, BPM and key and how to arrange it. So now that they've arranged the beat, we're getting them to test out their vocals. And this is the hardest part. It's where confidence is key. So they're just finding like the sounds that they would like to appear as for his vocals. Usually we'll start with teaching them like hum some noises, make some sounds, and then we'll get into, okay, let's change up from sounds to words. So we're kind of in that stage right now.
My name's Talon. I'm a 20-year-old Indigenous entrepreneur and recording artist. I'm from Treaty 4 territory, more specifically Paiute Nation. So right now, I'm just listening to the beat. Whatever comes to my head, I'm writing down, and we're going to lay it down after. This is called the process. I'm thinking, come on, something like you know, like more like a swag type flow, you know, not too much, just so that the listener can, you know, listen to what we're saying. This song really resonates with me, or this beat, you know, beats can really like touch emotion, you know. So this one, I don't like to write lyrics. I like to write emotions, you know, because it's all in your heart. You just gotta navigate and find it, and then bring it to life. I don't know. We'll see what it brings out of me. So this space is a space where I can learn and I can teach as well, because there are younger youth than I am, and I can teach them and show them, yeah. We need spaces like this space, you know, where we can come together, we can pray, we can enjoy a good time, have a good time, you know, because I feel like a lot of these youth don't have like the best circumstances or positions, so having programs like this really just, you know, brings the most out of the youth. I mean, I didn't have a dad growing up, so I mean, I'm sure this is some of the cases, you know, or like no parents or in the system and stuff like that. I was in the system when I was 3 years old for 3 months, so yeah, I wasn't too long, but I know a lot of my peers and youth have come from these circumstances.
Having an outlet to express what might be going on for you internally, whether it's like a conscious or subconscious thing that you're doing within your creative practice, I think that has a big influence on how a lot of young people are regulating, whether they realize it or not. I know for myself, like starting music production at a young age, for me it was something that really kind of just helped me, yeah, regulate all the time, sort of process through things that I was going through. And I don't think that's necessarily something that you consciously do at that age, but when you're in it, it's something that kind of just inherently happens for you. And I think any sort of creative outlet and any level of like expression is going to help young folks work through whatever it is that they're going through. So
hip-hop has always been a language for those who needed a voice. Hip-hop saved my life, and I hope and expect it to save some of these kids' lives too.
You just heard mentors and mentees at Landback Labs, busy cooking up some fresh new tunes. The mentorship program was started by Dakota Bear. He's the co-founder of Landback Records, a label created for aspiring Indigenous artists. When Dakota first started writing, he was writing to escape a tumultuous childhood. That passion for writing eventually turned into a passion for music and ultimately helped him turn his life around. Dakota, who is Nehiyo and originally from Treaty 6 in Saskatoon, joins me now. Welcome to Unreserved.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm honored to be here.
Let's start with a little bit about you. What inspired you to write initially?
Writing for me has always been a way of self-expression. Growing up, I feel like having an outlet, having a way to express yourself is something that's so essential, especially dealing with trauma, intergenerational trauma. So it just came natural to me. I had a family that was going through a lot of traumas. We're dealing with a lot of poverty and addictions. And, you know, my grandma, my great grandma, my mom, my grandpa, everyone's been to residential school, you know, and from there it's really hard to try and work through a lot of those things. And growing up, I didn't understand a lot of that. And I think just being able to draw towards some kind of creative outlet helped me tremendously in being able to express some of the things that I was feeling.
Mm-hmm. What kinds of writings were you creating to help you, you know, escape or deal with that situation?
It was mostly just short stories. I would be writing a lot of stories, just like fictional stories, poems. I would turn them into like little poems. And then growing up, I watched a hip-hop based movie called 8 Mile.
We got Papa Doc and we got B-Rabbit. Now I don't even have to stress how important this is.
That really changed my outlook on music, because I was kind of just listening to things on the radio, and you know, I didn't have a lot of musical influences, but as soon as I watched that movie, feeling the parallels of going through poverty and hip-hop and expressing, I really decided that I want to start writing hip-hop songs now. I got the CD to listen to, and then when I got that inspiration, then hip-hop just really became a thing into my life, where I just started to really focus and build on it, and I was about 13, 14.
Mm. And you're referring to the movie 8 Mile, Eminem's autobiography.
Yeah, yeah.
I love me some Eminem.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Total urban poet, don't you agree?
Yeah, for real.
Now who's afraid of the big bad wolf? 1, 2, 3 into the 4. 1 pop, 2 pop, 3 pop, 4. 4 pop, 3 pop, 2 pop, 1. Your pop, he's pop, no pop, none.
There's a lot of like lyricism, I think, that was really, for me, motivating and empowering, because I was already using, you know, words and lyrics and trying to think of like different types of poems and stuff. And when I got introduced to that and that level of lyricism, that's when I kind of was getting myself aligned with that. Okay, now I want to start expressing myself through music. So, you know, 13, 14, 15, finding my musical influences, all old school 90s hip hop, like Nas, Big L, Mobb Deep, Eminem, just the beats, the music, the lyrics, the self-expression, how hip hop started. And then when I was 16 years old, because I used to be into boxing and skateboarding and things like that. But when I was around 16 years old, my birthday was coming up. And my mom, we were going through a lot, right? But my mom really wanted to support what I was doing. So I was already in boxing classes. I was already doing that, wanting to think about entering competitions for boxing. And then music was a big part of my life. So she was just asking me, like, you know, we can choose one of these things, like these workout machines and stuff like that, or I can look to get you a microphone. It was a hard decision for me because I really love boxing. There's a lot of rhythm. So much to it. But ultimately, I went with the microphone.
Do you remember the first time that you got to perform one of your pieces in front of an audience?
I do. When I first had my release of my mixtape, and it's something that I was working on, just as soon as I got this microphone, it was nonstop for me. Mm. I'd wake up, I'd be so excited to figure out how can I mix these songs, how can I get these songs out, put them onto YouTube, researching and marketing, things like that. And then so I got really dedicated. I made my first CD and my first mixtape. And I was still a fairly new artist. I was just kind of getting myself out there. But my mom, she really wanted to help me get my first show. So she started like putting money together, like funds and like fundraising and stuff, so that we put our first show was the one that we put on. Like my mom was involved in like helping. And that was pretty much like one of the first times performing my music was the show that we were already like putting together ourselves, you know? And that was really exciting for me because I never had that experience before. It was very nerve-wracking as well. A lot of my friends and stuff were there, family. But that was really my first experience of being able to go onto a stage and perform songs that I've recorded. And then it just kind of started growing from there.
Mm. And how long was it before you came up with the idea for Land Back Records?
Land Back Records is fairly new, honestly. It's only been, I feel like, a couple years since it was really just like an Instagram page. I've been in the music industry for some time, right? Like coming out to Vancouver, I was 19 years old and I didn't know really anyone out here. I always felt like I needed to travel to really get new opportunities. And ultimately, it was hard to try like find a manager, find someone to help me take it to the next level. So I went to 2 different music schools. I learned as much as I could in the music business programming side of things, about press releases, how to do book shows, etc. Everything there is to kind of learn about music business stuff. I just never felt like it was a space for Indigenous people. Mm-hmm. You know, I never felt like we really had that space, that somewhere where we could really be ourselves, express freely, like just being able to feel supported. Like it wasn't really like that. You know, it just really started with an Instagram page. It really just started with an idea, inspiration, something that I seen we could really use for ourselves. And then from there, just connect with the right people, creating the team. And now it's starting to really pick up.
Mm. Was that what ultimately motivated you to start the record company? Were these gaps where there were Indigenous voices that were missing, or what was it that ultimately led you to that?
I think just being frustrated with what I was seeing in the music industry and different like award shows. There's like the Indigenous category, here you are, you know. But another thing is just, you know, going to festivals and just hearing stories, even with my partner, her group, you know, they would get like these small like Indigenous stages kind of like off to the side, and those kind of things just made me feel frustrated, you know, like why can't we just be able to be in the same space, you know, why can't we just be afforded kind of those same opportunities. But I guess we just have to build them ourselves, and that's what we're really doing. It's, you know, building these platforms ourselves, building out distribution ourselves, building out booking systems ourselves, marketing plans, marketing teams and agencies, and then just running it up, stay Indigenous focused, Indigenous led, Indigenous owned, to just really focus on revitalizing our own economy.
Mm. And how does your label, Landback Records, treat artists differently than maybe a different record label would?
At Landback Records, we believe in ownership should always be to the artists, 100%. You know, and there's different ways that we can work with artists that will help them, you know, maybe just think of themselves as a business and build their own. Or I'll offer services that we can provide to help them get there, or, you know, think about different ways and different innovative deals that we can help them get to that next level. How can we teach them what we know in the music industry so they can navigate it? And if they have that for themselves, then they can build that for themselves. Like, we could duplicate that and they could build another record label, they could build another booking agency. Like, because entrepreneurship runs in our blood, and before contact, we were already entrepreneurs. We already had our kinship systems, our ties, our mediums of exchange, our trade networks. We had everything already. And so because that's already in us, I truly believe that, you know, being self-determining and being able to have that is something that is really important these days, is that we could show them how to do these things. You know, we can run them through and they don't have to go through a big music school like I did, and, you know, having to take out student loans and just like, institutions in general is hard to navigate. So I think that's what really separates us, is that we really put focus on how can we mentor artists, especially young Indigenous artists, to understand this music industry, whether they just have their first song out or, you know, their 50th song out, to be able to give that knowledge, give that mentorship, and then just kind of take it from there.
Mm. Why do you feel it's so important to support Indigenous youth in this way and helping them make their own music and build their own, you know, labels and records?
I think that any type of mentorship for Indigenous youth is so important, because growing up, I never really had a lot of that. We're all going through so much stuff. You know, there's all so much happening in our own lives that it was hard to for me to, like, sometimes even just like take that advice in, because I'm struggling with addictions, I'm going through this poverty. Like, I think it's so important, and the little, you know, bit that I was able to like hang on to helped me tremendously in my life, you know. And I feel like just being able to offer a bit of support and help and opportunity to see themselves on these stages, to see other people that look like them, I think that's so empowering, that's so motivating, that's so inspirational, that it's just infectious, you know. You just want to be able to continue to create things that are going to be beneficial to others. And as Indigenous people, it's literally a part of our DNA. We think of us as a collective, not individualism. And that's where colonialism has really impacted us, is that it's just back to the individual. You know, it's like a dog eat dog world, and the scarcity of all of these resources and connections, where we've always been open as a collective and put the health of our community, because we've always worked in that way. So I think really bringing that back to the forefront, thinking of reciprocity, what we can do for others and how that's going to be impactful and beneficial for the next seven generations, is something that will really align us, you know, with who we are as Indigenous people and how we can continue to grow as a collective.
Mm. How does your mentorship program work? Like, walk me through it. If I'm a student artist and I come to you, what are you going to be teaching me?
So in this space here, the youth are going to be invited here. We're going to do kind of presentations, more hands-on workshops with the equipment. We have microphone, we have computers, some laptops. We're going to do more creative sessions, I guess, and being able to have more time on the microphones, more time on the instruments, the machines to produce beats. And then after we kind of get all of the creative projects up and running, then we're going to mentor them on, okay, this is all the, how do you get your songs on Spotify? How do you get your songs on Apple Music? How do you get them online? How do you promote them? What's a good strategy to create content? How do you make other streams of revenue off of your music, to really show them, okay, you know, there's streaming, but there's also synchronizations, licensing, there's also different types of royalties, there's bookings, there's all sorts of revenues that can be, you know, explored off making music, and really just open them up to the music industry, the world of music, you know, how to see that as a way to make a living.
And as you move forward with Landback, with your mentorship program, with all of the warrior entrepreneurship that you were involved in. What are you most excited to see?
I'm really excited to see all the projects that come out. I'm really excited to see all the business ideas that come out. I'm really excited to connect further with the Indigenous youth of the community, to really provide that mentorship. So there's a lot of different things. And I feel like, you know, having our kids around, we have two children, and having our kids around to be able to experience all of this and just be involved in all of this is just really going to be able to open up, you know, how impactful it is, how influential that it is when we give back, when we take the time to really inspire younger people, you know, to really create opportunities and pathways. I think it's just, it's really infectious. The positivities, the opportunities, the inspirations, the creativity. It's so good to be around other like-minded individuals that are just on the same path, on the same mission, you know? So yeah, we're really excited. We're really grateful, and we really can't wait to launch this pilot program.
Well, Dakota, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Dakota Bear is a Neheyo hip-hop artist and activist from Treaty 6 territory in Saskatoon. He is now residing on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, or Tsleil-Waututh peoples in Vancouver, British Columbia. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Coming up, one bead, multiple stories. We'll hear how Michaela Thompson uses beadwork to trace the stories of her African and Indigenous ancestries. But first, Afro-Indigenous rapper Mama Rude Gal, MTHC, found her voice through music. She says hip-hop is a tool for oppressed people to be heard. This is Mama Rude Gal, MTHC, with Freedom.
Tangible, intangible, unmanageable, free.
That is Mama Rude Gal, MTHC, with Freedom. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Michaela Thompson learned to bead alongside her maternal grandmother on the Lapwai Reservation. It's a tradition, an art form that has existed on that side of her family for generations. And while every art piece that Michaela creates includes an homage to her grandmother, her beadwork has evolved to include other parts of her identity and history. Michaela is Black and Namipu from Lapwai, Idaho. She beads the two sides of her cultural identity to create one signature style, because she wants people to see all of who she is. Michaela, welcome to Unreserved.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
So tell me about the first time you learned how to bead.
Yes. So I am originally from the East Coast, and me and my mom and my sister moved over to my res in Lapwai. 2003 is when we moved. And so we moved in with my grandmother initially. And so she was a bead worker. Her mother used to bead as well. And so going into the house, there was beads, you know, lined stacked up in her closets and cans that weren't supposed to be beads. And it was just amazing. And so after seeing her work, I was just like, you know, I want to learn how to do this. And so that's when I decided to ask her, and she was like, yeah, let's do it. You tell me what you want to bead and I'll teach you how to do it. So of course I go big and I want to do this huge barrette that's like 6 inches. I never finished it, but I think I still have the beginning stages of it. And so I've been beading ever since then. It was always just kind of a hobby. And then the last 3 years, I was like, I'm going to go full time with it. So I was grateful enough to have my kata, as we call her, Chloe Half Moon. I was able to have her at my fingertips as a child and, you know, learn from one of the greats.
And how old were you when you picked up, you know, the beads and the needle?
I was 10. Yeah, I learned at 10. And so I was going strong with it for a while. And then, you know, of course, we don't have FaceTime and things like that back then. And so we moved from my grandmother's. We moved over to my mom was going to SKC, Salish Kootenai College. And so we moved over there. And I had all these unfinished projects to the point to where I just kind of fell off. And I was like, I don't know how to finish these projects. And so I didn't pick it back up until college. And I was like, I'm just going to kind of figure it out and make the mistakes. And so ever since then, I've been going strong.
Beadwork, of course, is really hard work. I think they should call it hard beadwork.
Yeah.
You know, the tiny little beads, the sewing, the tautness of it. Like my mom tried to teach me how to beadwork and I was completely useless. What was it about this particular way of being creative that really connected you to, you know, your identity, your history, your grandma?
I find that beadwork is just very healing. A lot of people kind of attach it to that as well because you're just zoned in and it takes so much patience and you have the ultimate control of every single bead, how things look. I mean, it's art, you know, and I think a lot of people, they tie it to just regalia and powwows, and which is beautiful. And it's, you know, that's how it's always been and that's how it's always going to be. But to step back and look at the overall picture, like, no, this is an art form. You know, it's very intricate. It takes a lot of concentration. And so deciding to really kind of dive deep into it and having that understanding and gaining that understanding along the way has been a really fun journey. At first, it was just a connection to my family, knowing, hey, my grandmother does this. And seeing all of these big, amazing projects and thinking, you know, I want to do that too someday. And I want to put my stamp out there and seeing old pieces from like decades and decades and knowing, oh, you can have your imprint in the world forever if you want to, you know, if you do it right. You know. And so I was like, yeah, this is something I want to be a part of. This is something I want to do. And, you know, as a kid, you don't look at that huge overall picture, but just knowing, hey, my kata did this, my grandmother did this. I want to do this too. And now looking into it, it totally centers me in so many different ways. And it's cool that I can do it full time, but not feel like work, but also creating the story that I want to create. And even though it's the story that I'm creating, people look at it and they have their own story and their own connection. So I think it's very beautiful in that way to be able to not only share who I am, but also connect with others in their own way through this art form.
It's kind of mind-blowing, isn't it, to think, you know, just as we look at you know, our ancestors' pieces in museums and, you know, collections and so on and think, wow, that was made like 200, 300 years ago to think that maybe your pieces would also, you know, stand in a museum as this was made by Michaela Thompson. Exactly. Isn't that mind-blowing?
It is. It really is. And so that's why, like, I've had the awesome opportunity to kind of pay that forward in whatever ways that I could by, you know, teaching other people how to bead. We've gotten our awesome little classes going and our beadwork baddies group, as we called it. And so we meet every other week and we bead. And it's been awesome to hear those stories from other people as well. Just realizing, you know, I wasn't taught this art form, or I started to, but, you know, my grandmother, my mother passed away, or, you know, so it's having all these different stories to, and then realizing, hey, yeah, they're doing the same things and wanting to have the same outcomes of having this work and kind of creating a new craft or path within their families and their communities that will last generations, you know. So it's been really cool to kind of witness that, but also be a part of it at the same time.
You mentioned that you're from the Nimiipuu Nation. Does that nation have a particular style of beadwork, and do you try to emulate it?
Yeah, and so I use a lot of traditional influences that we use during trade. And so, of course, there's so many different beaders who have their own style now. You know, it's really kind of up to you and your style if you choose to kind of draw from those influences. But I choose to draw from the ones kind of from way back and using a specific color palette, because during trade, we only had access to so many colors in the beginning. What we use kind of resembled our land and our people and what we're, you know, what was important to us. I basically just took kind of like a chunk of years, a certain amount of years, and I just kind of dive deep into some of those histories and really kind of, because no, I never really seen it analyzed, like beadwork analyzed. And so I kind of did this little write-up of what parts of our homeland some of our Nimiipuu beaders were from and why they were beading in this style. And I really just tried to kind of tie it all together and then kind of pick the pieces I wanted in order to kind of replicate or try. So I just did my research as well, but then also looking at some of my great-grandmother's pieces and her little beadwork baddies group, in a sense, to her and her friends and her, you know, all of her beaders she would bead with, and her friends, looking at some of their works, a lot of the florals and roses and flat bags that they either had on hand or that she made. So looking at all of the different types of work that we did was always really fascinating to me.
Mm. You're also Afro-Indigenous. What did it take to learn about this part of your identity?
With being Black Native, again, I grew up kind of on the East Coast for the first 10 years of my life, and then we moved over to the res, me and my mom. And so my mom grew up on the res, and kind of getting that connected with that side of the family was very easy to do, just because it was very natural of moving back to the res. I was able to be very much so around my family, and the very natural of, you know, being a res kid and getting into trouble and doing different things, and then also just going to powwows on the regular. So, you know, especially with the Black side, you know, that's something you have to kind of, it's not as accessible as, you know, your native side, and understanding who your ancestors are and being tied to the land. That's something you really have to research, or you just have to get to understand the history and the importance of your own people.
In terms of beadwork, what did you learn about the beadwork traditions of your African ancestors? I wasn't even aware that there was like a beadwork sort of
tradition. And that's the thing, is there's so many commonalities against Black and Native people that goes further than oppression. You know, it's the ties to our people, our community, the way we handle our hair, you know, some of these crafts and these art forms and these designs, it's like everything means something, you know, to who we are. And so when I started to kind of incorporate some of those Nigerian and African designs into my patterns, I actually took ancestry. And so I took ancestry because I wanted to know, okay, what's going on my Black side? You know, where do I come from here? And so when I got that back, there were so many different, it was Nigerian, Benin, and Togo. There was so many different things. And I was like, okay, eventually I want to dive deeper. Like, what tribes can I get from those specific nations? And so I haven't gotten that far yet. That's a whole nother kit I gotta, you know, submit DNA to. But I was like, okay, well, at least I know I'm like 40%, you know, descending from Nigeria. So I'm gonna kind of look at their patterns and what did they use and what is this meaning of these designs. And so I've been just kind of researching different designs and learning how to incorporate them. An example of one of them that I recently did was, it's called the Gatherer's Handbag. And so along the middle of that bag, I have a very common Nigerian pattern that I decided to use. And on the outside, I use very common kind of geometric style Nimiipuu kind of patterns and colors. And so yeah, being able to tie both of those in there, even though they have specific meaning of the pattern itself, but then also has meaning to me as the artist, and that this is who I am. It's literally my identity and where I come from. That can mean something else to someone else and be like, oh yeah, this African pattern is very similar to, you know, my tribal nation's pattern or whatever. So it's being able to just pull different things and different parts of me that I'm learning along the way and then putting it into my work as well. And that's where I've been recently and currently.
It's very cool to see how, you know, your art or your creative expression can change based on, you know, life-changing things like DNA testing and finding out that you're from Nigeria and also from Nimipu.
That was very gratifying as well. So it's like, you know what, I want to be all of me. And I think growing up, I just felt like I had to be this or I had to be that. And if this is native beadwork, I need to be all native within this art form. It's like, no, you know, I make the rules. I think once I realized there are no rules, fear doesn't exist. You can do whatever you want to do. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to learn along the way. I'm going to put stuff out there, you know, that I just felt like making in that moment. And so once I kind of released the pressures of just society, I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to do what I want to do. You know, I have my meanings for it. And once I put my meanings attached to or was a little bit more descriptive in some of my work, that was the story. There was a story attached to it and people found fascination in that. And they're like, we want more of this. So I'm like, great. Like, because I'm doing it anyway. So I think once I just kind of released the expectations and just went into making what I wanted to make, especially with beadwork, a lot of times it is regalia. It is earrings all the time. And I'm like, you know, I kind of want to shift that a little bit. I want to do wall canvases. I want to get back to doing large bags and just really doing everything that I specifically wanted to do, not nothing that I felt like I needed to do or felt like, you know what, this is what everybody else is doing, so I'm going to go ahead and do it too.
Why is it important to do that, to finally let go of those what beadwork should be, only all native and, you know, just that there are no rules? Why was that important for you to realize and represent in your work?
That was a life realization. I think everybody needs to let go of what should be and, you know, look towards what could be. And it's an ongoing what could be. And I think we need to more so embody all of ourselves. And as you get older, it's like, this is what I tell kids too. It's, I'm like, what seems cool right now is not going to be cool when you're older. You know, it's, we look to people, we hang out with people. The people that get recognition are people that are completely themselves, even the ugly parts, you know? So it's like, get comfortable with those insecurities, get comfortable with whatever your story is, the good, the bad, the ugly, and that's what makes you beautiful. Own it, you know, and it comes with work too. You're not gonna like everything you create, you know, in the moment, but when I look back on it now, I'm like, no, this was great. What was I thinking? You know, I was overthinking everything. This is a great piece. And it's the same thing with life, to where it's like we overthink everything and feel like we have to be these certain things. And overall, all of you is what makes you beautiful. It's how you kind of take that and move forward with it and walk forward with it and go and keep trying and keep creating. And so it all goes hand in hand. So yeah, it takes a minute to kind of get there, but the sooner you can get there, the better. And realizing, you know, I decide what my failures are. I decide what my successes are. And what may be a loss for somebody is a win for me. And it really all is just kind of mental. And artwork is mental in that way too. It's just, you get to decide how you tell your story.
Yeah. Often I hear from, you know, bead workers, particularly from the previous generation, or grandmothers and aunties, who say you kind of have to leave a tiny little bit of an imperfection in your work so that it keeps you humble.
Yep. I've heard multiple different names for it, but spirit bead is the most common. And so I do put a spirit bead in each of my pieces, and it comes specifically from my Katsa's collection. And so she, that whole closet full of beads, you know, she was always like, just take what you want. And so I have a few beads from her. And so I take one bead from one specific color, from one specific hank, one specific style, and I put that in there. And that's kind of like my signature, but it's also like an ode to her for teaching me how to bead as well. So a little bit of piece of hers in each of my pieces.
I love that. People are going to be pulling out your pieces and going, where is it? Where?
I know. I had one person, they're like, oh, I found it. It's this and it looks like this. And I was like, okay, I didn't want you to say anything, but it's cool. Like, you know, I like it to be a little special. But yeah.
And as you look towards the future, what do you hope to accomplish with your beadwork?
I don't know. I guess I don't really have too many expectations as to what I hope to accomplish. I feel like, you know, it's kind of like, you know, what do you hope to achieve, or what kind of imprint do you hope to put on the world? It's like, I don't determine that. And so it's the same thing with my accomplishments. Like, I think me being able to bead is an accomplishment in myself. As long as my eyes are working, my fingers are moving, like I hope can personally accomplish is that I'm still creating what is important to me. And I hope to have a collection of pieces that, you know, my family has and, you know, that are lasting and ongoing in the world. But that's all that I hope to really accomplish is that my beadwork doesn't fall apart and it's lasting for generations. Who it impacts isn't up to me, but I hope it does have some sort of impact on somebody.
Thank you so much for your time today, Michaela.
Thank you.
Michaela Thompson is an Afro-Indigenous beadwork artist from the Namipu Nation. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, life and art in the intersections. Evelyn Campbell is thought to be one of the first, if not the first, Inuk teacher in Canada. Born in 1928, Evelyn was educated in the residential school system and went on to Teachers College from there. As a student, Evelyn was made to feel ashamed of her Inuit culture, but as a teacher, she wanted to share it and make sure that Inuk students felt like they belonged. One way she brought her culture into the classroom was through music.
She really embraced the changes that came with the Labrador Inuit Association when they started to have a say in what could be included in curriculum. Her favorite part, of course, was music, because she played the organ in church and in school.
It was actually brought to Rigolet on a Comatic with a dog team. And when it was in our house, the straps broke. So Poppy took some seal skin that he had for boots and made straps out of it.
That's a clip from the documentary Miss Campbell, Inuk Teacher. And that voice is Heather Campbell, Evelyn's granddaughter. Heather wanted to celebrate her grandmother, so she created a documentary to preserve her story and her legacy. Heather, welcome to Unreserved.
Hi, thank you.
Tell me about your grandmother. Who was Evelyn Campbell?
She was born Evelyn Shiwok. We had learned later that Shiwok was an anglicized version of Sikwok, which means thin ice in Inuktitut. But yeah, she was just a little small Inuit woman, but very strong and had a very powerful voice. And she loved to sing loud in church. And she always had like the little permed hair and the glasses and her cardigans.
Oh my gosh, that's adorable.
So she was born just outside Rigolet and she had four brothers. Her mother passed away when she was young. So all of them ended up going to the residential school after that. But she was really lucky. Her father was the mailman, so she got to see him once a month. So I think that really helped.
Is it true that she kept her sister out of residential school and other students?
Yes, I interviewed a number of people, a number of elders and relatives here in Northwest River, which is where the school was actually located. And I interviewed people in our hometown of Rigolet as well. And I came across at least three stories of instances where she kept students out of the school. So I don't know how she did it, but it was my Aunt Laura came up to go to school, but somehow my grandmother got her to stay with the local family instead of having to stay at the dorms.
So she just talked people into into taking these kids in. Do you know why she wanted to become a teacher?
I tell a story in the film about the attitudes I think that the teachers that she had with her and the other students, and how she was very defiant about that. And I think that inspired her, just having not very good teachers growing up. She wanted to be better than that.
Tell me a little bit about how Evelyn brought Inuit culture into her classroom.
Yeah, one of the subjects that she taught in school was music. She played the organ in church and also in school. That was a way that she would incorporate local music into the curriculum. She knew that it was powerful to have music that we could all relate to, that, you know, talked about fishing and hunting and trapping and all the things, you know, and all the people that were in our region.
And why do you think she wanted to do that, besides, of course, her love of music?
Yeah, I think it's just her recognizing that people wanted to see themselves in the school system and being able to highlight Inuit and Labrador culture within the school made it something that you're proud of.
Mm. I understand that you were also a student of hers. What was that experience like to be taught by your grandmother about Inuit culture?
Well, I don't think we thought very much about what type of culture it was back then. We were all just who we were. Like, this is a town of like 350 people at the time, and everyone knew each other. And as children, we didn't pay much attention to race, I don't think, until, you know, when you move away and then you realize that things are different in your hometown versus, you know, on the island of Newfoundland, for example, when I went to university.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, just knowing that friends and family were included in some of these songs, it was very powerful for us.
Mm. And were you aware that this is my grandmother and my teacher? How did you feel about that?
She taught me, I think, the way she would teach anyone else. I didn't feel as if I was getting any special treatment. I think maybe sometimes she was a bit harder on me because I was her granddaughter and I should be an example of what other kids were, you know, supposed to look up to, I think. So I did feel a bit of pressure that way to perform very well in school. And she was tough like that in terms of grades and my behavior. And like, even when I went to university, I swear to God, my first year, I was 18 years old. When I came home, I still had to go home at 10 o'clock at night.
And what about for other students and the community? How did her teaching impact the community?
I think representation matters so much. Just being able to see someone that looks like you doing the things that she was able to do, I think was very important for everyone, mm-hmm. despite, you know, how they may have felt about her personally, because she was so strict. Yeah, I think overall we have one of, if not the highest graduation rate for all of the communities on the north coast of Labrador. And I think it's partially because of her.
Because she made everybody go home at 10 o'clock?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, there was no such thing as people not showing up for school, you know. She would call the parents and say, where is little Johnny? Like, he's supposed to be in school.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there was no skipping out.
You had spoken to some of her former students for your film. What did they have to say about her?
Yeah, like, everyone does speak of her strictness, but she was also fair as well. Like, you know, if you were doing well, then she would acknowledge it. I know with myself, she was the same way. I don't think her teaching style changed a lot from when my mom was a kid versus when I was a kid. But one thing that I'll say is, there's one thing that she never, ever believed in, and no one ever could accuse her of this, was that she never, ever used physical punishment. There was one teacher that used the ruler on us, including me, and that teacher did not stick around very long. She was gone by Christmas, I think.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the challenges that this is, you know, back in the day, right? And as the saying goes, what were some of the challenges your grandmother faced as a teacher?
She was very good at sort of keeping a lot of that, all of her work things at work. But looking back on it now as an adult and having worked in federal government and institutions and that kind of thing, that culture versus Rigolet culture, Inuit culture is very different.
Mm-hmm.
So I can only imagine how difficult it was for her to maneuver those two cultures and sort of be a bridge between the two of them. You know, it must have taken a toll, really.
Yeah, I imagine. What do you think kept Evelyn going through, you know, some of the hardships she might have been experiencing?
You know, I think when she was younger, she probably did rely on her faith a lot. The whole time I was growing up, she would read the Bible every single night before she went to bed. She went to church every Sunday. And and then in the summers, my grandfather was a hunter and a fisherman and a trapper. And we'd go away every summer. We stayed at our summer place all summer long. So I think that was the break that she needed to just be a wife and a grandma and, you know, do all of the things related to fishing and cooking and that kind of thing. I think it really grounded her, having that time with the land and nature.
Mm-hmm. Heather, why is it important for you to tell your grandmother Evelyn's story?
I think we hear a lot of negative stories about things that had happened, especially in her time. And we don't hear enough stories of people that were able to get through all of that and still make something positive out of it. And I think an even smaller percentage of Inuit stories that are out there. So I love thinking that other Inuit all across Canada are going to be able to hear her story. People here in Labrador, and then even people that knew her their whole lives, there are probably things that they didn't think about before. And I'm hoping that it'll shed some light on her unique situation and that they will have a better understanding of why she was the way that she was.
Your grandmother since passed in 2013. But how has, you know, revisiting and researching her story changed your relationship to your grandmother?
I think I was able to maybe forgive her for some things, like for that for that strictness that she had, or I have a better understanding now of sort of PTSD and intergenerational trauma that maybe I didn't have when I was younger. And kind of understanding her reactions to things and her views on things, how that was shaped by what everything that had happened to her in school. It was very healing in that way.
And when other people watch this doc, what do you hope that they take away from her story?
I want people to see the amazing power of one person. You know, we all think we're just one person and what can we do? But truly one person, when they dedicate their life to something, can achieve a lot. Mm-hmm. Even if it's just for one community, that ripple effect is still going. We have so many amazing artists in particular from Rigolet specifically, with people that are in government. Everyone's doing so much, and I think all of us have a sense of responsibility to our community and to Inuit culture as well. Mm. And I'm really proud of our community.
That's beautiful. How do you think she would feel about it? What do you think she would, you know, say to you after watching a documentary about herself and that ripple effect that she started?
I think she'd be a little embarrassed, but proud. But I remember asking her, I had a cousin that had become a nurse. And I say, you know, how do you feel about Dolores becoming a nurse? And she's like, oh, I'm so proud. You know, and I could hear it in her voice that she was truly proud of what her students were accomplishing back then. And I think she'd be beaming if she saw everyone now.
Heather, thank you for sharing this with me today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Heather Campbell is an Inuk filmmaker and the granddaughter of Evelyn Campbell. Miss Campbell Inuk Teacher was created in partnership with the National Film Board. You can watch it for free on their website. That's all our time on Radio Indigenous. This episode was produced by Kim Kasher, Danielle Piper, Rhiannon Johnson, Elena Hudgens-Lyle, and Zoe Tennant. I'm your favorite cousin, Rosanna Deerchild, coming at you from Winnipeg in Treaty 1 territory. Ganaskinamit Nawal. I go say.